Hey everyone, this is the Divine It Girl Radio Show. I am your host, Jessica Nevins, and we are back again for another amazing episode of Invoking the Muse. I am so excited. We have a filmmaker with us here today. Welcome, Jeff McCarty. Jeff, hello, welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you very much. Divine It Girl.
Yep. Yes, that's me. Thank
like,
you
how'd
for
you get
being
that name?
Here.
Divine It Girl.
How did I come up with it?
Yeah.
It was divinely inspired.
All right. That's all I need to know.
Actually, it was one of those things. Talk about the muse. It was one of those things that was very much the muse was alive and well, because I think I got that idea in the shower, which for me,
I
get some of my
a lot of
best ideas in the shower.
Come out of the shower. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it just popped into my head, and I remember being a little leery about it, because I was like, isn't that a little, over the top? Isn't that a little arrogant? And it was like, no, it was like, this is fun. This is actually fun and magical and really silly and amazing. okay. So I just went with it, and I played with it for a little bit before I renamed the show, because the show was originally named Ye Intentional Living and just wasn't popping.
Okay.
So,
yeah, Divine It Girl has a little bit more of a pop to it.
Yeah, it does. It's a lot more
yeah.
fun. And see, that's part of my brand is the whole fun thing, right? So I was like, oh, yeah, and I could bring in the sparkles and the fun. And
Do you know who the original It Girl was?
No. Who was it?
Clara Bow, the silent film actress. She was tagged
really?
As the It Girl in the 1920s. And she was like a famous flapper, actress. She was in a lot of the very saucy and sexy pre-code films of the 20s. And, she was called the It Girl. And ever since then, that term has kind of, continued on through the decades to, whoever is, the big shining star of the moment is always usually, classified as the It Girl. Some people would consider maybe Jennifer Lawrence the It Girl right now,
right.
as far as Hollywood goes. But, yeah.
That is so cool. I had no idea what you hear
yeah.
the term all the time, but I had no idea what the origin was,
yeah.
so... That's amazing.
In fact, her first film was even called It.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, how funny. I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah, yeah. Also, fun film. It's good. I highly recommend it. I recommend all her films. She was a very fun actress to watch on the screen.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, as you can see, we have someone very knowledgeable in film here. Let me tell you a little bit about Jeff so you get the background on him is pretty amazing. He's a native of Chicago and alumni of USC School of Cinema and Television. And he's an independent filmmaker, which I already mentioned. He has written, produced, directed, and edited many independent films, including The Ballad of Ponyboy, which recently won the Best Retrospective Film Award at the 2015 Burbank International Film Festival. Yay!
About time that film won an award.
I know, right? Well, that came out in what?
2004. And
2004. Oh,
yeah,
was it that long ago?
Yeah, it was that long ago. And now it's 2015, and just the fact that I got a Best Retrospective Film Award kind of means I'm kind of old, right? Because retrospective is like a blast from the past.
I see retrospective as a little different, though.
No, I know. It's actually very cool. I mean, the fact that a film that was made 10 years ago, a small indie film, is actually getting play 10 years later and enjoyed and actually wins an award, like a retro award. I mean, shows right there the film has some sort of staying power, which is really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. That's really exciting. And I got the privilege to work with Jeff on that.
Yes, you did. You created the poster art for it.
I did.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
My wife took
wow.
the photograph, and you did all the artwork and the compositing.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. It seems like it was like a century ago, but it also seems like it was 2 minutes ago. It's the weirdest thing.
I know.
It's
that's how time is.
Yeah, well, on top of all of that, Jeff being a filmmaker, he has also spent the last 17 years working in film restoration for both Paramount Pictures and Technicolor. He has personally supervised the restoration of classics such as Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, The Big Parade, Mr. Hulot's Holiday, Roman Holiday, and currently he is working on Saturday Night Fever. He has also lectured, instructed, and taught film restoration for such respected institutions as the George Eastman House and University of Syracuse. So there it all is. It's all out. The cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, I guess those are the big highlights. You know, there's some other things, but I think you hit on all the, you know, the big important stuff.
Well, I just, you know, right before Jeff and I hopped on here, we were talking about this current project he's working on. I was so fascinated with it, and he's currently working on restoring Saturday Night Fever over there at Paramount. And
almost 40 years old now.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it came out in 1977.
I see it as the perfect period piece for the disco.
Oh, it is. I mean, that was a
perfect period piece.
That was a crazy summer in New York City. You know, that was a summer where they suffered huge blackouts, and the city was like dark for like half the summer.
Really?
It was a huge heat wave. It was the Son of Sam killings were going on.
That's what I was going to ask, if that was that summer. Oh, my gosh.
It was that summer. And, then, of course, disco and punk were all the rage. And,
right.
You know, like, yeah, so, and Saturday Night Fever is kind of a nice snapshot of that culture, especially the disco culture.
Yeah.
And, and Travolta, I have newfound respect for Travolta. I actually, believe it or not, had not seen Saturday Night Fever as a child or even as a teenager or at all until recently I started working on it. Which is kind of crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I've grown to really love the movie, especially Travolta's performance. He could have been much greater than he actually was, just based on, you know, the honesty of his portrayal of that character. And the dancing
was phenomenal.
The dancing is so much fun to watch. And
it really is. And, well, you know, growing up a dancer, I was always watching movies that had any kind of element of dance in them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Okay, then, of course,
so that's why I'm so obsessed with that movie, is I've watched it over and over again because I'm watching the dance sequences. It wasn't so much, you know, I don't think, you know, growing up, I don't even think I understood the movie. Mm-hmm. I had no idea of the subtext of the actual movie until I was an adult.
There's lots of dark stuff going on in that film.
There is lots of dark stuff going on in there. And
it really is.
I had no clue because I was just watching the dance parts of it.
Oh yeah.
In fact, I think you know, being a kid like with VHS, like fast forwarding through pretty much all of the movie except for the dance sequences. Whenever there's a dance sequence, I'd be like so focused on it and like so focused on replicating the moves. It's just like, you know, I've done that with so many different movies and even
probably like Flashdance, I'm guessing.
Flashdance was another one. Yeah, it's like these are like the classic, like, quote-unquote, dancer movies, you know.
Yeah.
And another movie that I loved, it's an old movie. And, I loved all these old movies when I was younger, right? Because I was like, wow, this is cool. Because it was like looking at dance in so many different ways. And
dance was very much celebrated, in, especially like films from the 30s through the 50s, even in the 60s a little bit.
Yeah, and then there was that drama with Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft, I think, The Turning Point.
I've not seen that film.
She was a retiring ballerina, and it was, I loved that movie, too. I mean, I was just, like, constantly obsessed with these movies, and Saturday Night Fever was one of those that I watched incessantly, like, all the time.
Well, then I'll do my best to invite you to our screening of it.
Oh, my gosh, thank you. I would love that. I would love to see that.
Which has two deleted scenes that you've probably never seen before.
Oh, my gosh, that is so exciting. Yeah. It's like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, like as I was telling you before the show started, we had lunch with John Badham, the director, and he said there were these two scenes in the film that he always wanted to put back in the film because they were full of poetry and emotion, but the studio made him cut it in 1977. And we said, sure, we'll put them back in now. So when you see it, tell me if you can point out the two scenes.
Okay, yeah, definitely. And I'm just curious, when you say, you know, the studio cut it for Poetry and Emotion, is it was because it was explicit in some way, or just
No,
because they were
no, you know,
trying to keep the length of the movie down?
there you go. That's all it was.
Okay.
That they were trying to, you know, find cuts where they could. And I mean, the movie survived without those cuts, but
Right.
I think they add, you know, some depth to the characterizations in the film.
Ooh, I love that.
So,
I can hardly
yeah.
wait to see that. I can hardly
Yeah,
wait
it's
to
pretty
see that.
cool.
Well, there's so much that we can dig in today. The
All right.
first thing that I want to ask you about, and I know a little bit about this because, but I want our listeners to learn just a little bit of background, is I've known Jeff for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah.
He is married to my best friend, who actually is like a sister to me. So Jeff's kind of like my brother-in-law.
And she's also an artist.
Yeah, she's also an artist. She's amazing. And we're like a little family, so I get the pleasure of having amazing conversations with him in their kitchen.
Yeah. I'm
We have
usually
some
over a
amazing
bottle of
conversations in that kitchen.
usually over a bottle of wine or
Yes.
scotch or
Scotch.
or
That's
whatever.
right. Or what? Oh, you made me a caipirinha one time too.
Oh,
That
I
was
did.
oh,
I did. I
that was
did.
a gift. That was a
Right?
gift. And we're going to talk about Jeff's love for Brazil. We're going to get into that as well too, because
Oh,
that's
yeah.
fascinating.
My
But
love hate for Brazil.
yes, love hate. That's right. I guess what I want to tip it off with, though, is understanding your creative process and what it feels like to you. What's the experience like? You know, what does it feel like when you're in it? What does it feel like when you're out of it? Just to give the audience an understanding of process and what it may feel like when they're having an experience of the muse or spirit moving
Right.
through them, or something, you know, regardless of whether it's an art or whether it's, you know, a process like, you know, an accountant or a scientist or a
Right,
mathematician
right.
finding a different, more creative way.
Well, I guess to really answer that question, I'd have to go back to when I was a child. Because that was probably, you know, the purest influence I had from a muse. Because like when you're a kid, you're not really judging anything you're doing. You know,
Yeah.
you're playing. And after I saw Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, Raiders of the Lost Ark as a child, I decided right then and there I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I thought of everything as a movie, like everything. And you know, I had all the action figures, me and my sister did. And we'd make up these long, involved stories with complicated plots, and they'd go on for days. We'd set up in my parents' basement, and you know, how about like this planet over here and this planet over or like over there? We weren't simply reenacting movies we saw; we were making our own movies, and we were pretending that we were actually filming them. And you know, we did all that without any sort of, again, no fear of judgment, no worries about, you know, how much is anything going to cost, or like where's our career
Right.
going, where's our lives going. Like, you don't have those worries as a child. So that's
Right.
probably. That's the most innocent, you know, way of creating, is to watch how children play, because they're not judging what they're doing. You know, they're not overanalyzing it. They're just letting it happen. And you know, like it's very free flowing. And that's kind of what we all have to get back to, you know, is that feeling of creation that we had as a child. Because, you know, in the
Yeah.
adult world, you can be distracted by so many things, and there's so many frustrations and worries and paranoias and anxieties that just can cripple you sometimes and leave you sitting there staring at a blank page in a typewriter for like 5 days.
God, yes.
Yeah, right?
Yes, I've been through that. It is not
Right.
pleasant.
But no children ever do that, right? I mean, children don't do
No.
that. They
No,
don't.
they don't.
I think it's what Joni Mitchell meant when she said we ought to get back to the garden. I mean, part of that garden is that garden
Yeah.
of a garden of youth. It's it's hard. You know, adults can't spend all the time in the garden because they do have these real world responsibilities. And as you get older, and you know, you're working in a certain medium, there are expectations of you. There's career expectations of you. There's financial expectations of you. All these things kind of weigh in and can sometimes get in the way and cripple, you know, that free flow of energy between you and your muse. So, I mean, that's the, you know, but at my best, I feel I'm tapping into the same exact energy I tapped into as a child.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, I mean, essentially, it really is.
Yeah.
Because the energy's always there. It's just a point of
It is
whether we
always
allow it
there.
in or
Absolutely.
just push it away, you
You have
know.
to have, you know, those transmitting towers up to, you know, to receive the energy.
Yep.
And sometimes they're down. There's high winds from finances, or your apartment roof's leaking, or the cat next door is scratching at your windows or whatever. But
there's a child screaming next door.
yes, there's that exactly. Or my own dear daughter, coming up to me and pulling me away from what I'm doing. As much as I love it, it's like there's all these little distractions that occur that don't allow you sometimes to really focus and go into that, zen-like meditative state that is best for letting, your muse, your creative process come forward. So, I mean, these days it can be sometimes quite a tortured process, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, I
Yeah, I
seriously
can imagine. Especially if you're in that flow and you're getting the ideas and they're coming, and then the phone call, there's a phone call that comes in that you have to pay attention to, or like you said, you get pulled away by
Exactly.
your
There's all
daughter,
that.
or
There's all that.
yeah, and then you're suddenly taken out of it, and it's like a little disorienting, and at the same
Right.
time, it's like, well, I have to do what I have to do too.
True. I mean, like the original idea that I have for something, like the initial inspiration for ideas is never hard. That I think is directly comes from a muse, if you will. Like, I could be walking in the mountains or something, and something just, hits me right. And all of a sudden I have like this great idea. Like those things just pop into my head through just being open, having your mind open to energy and life and the mountains around you and the flowers and the way light hits like a bookshelf during magic hour, or there's just certain things that kind of set off a chain of reactions that connect you to something else. Because something as simple as like a light shaft hitting a bookshelf at 5 p.m. might bring you back to a time that you were in your grandmother's house when you were 10, when that same kind of thing occurred, kind of like a deja vu thing. And then all of a sudden you have this idea for like this, maybe like this intricate family drama or something. So,
Right.
inspiration can come from anything or anywhere. For me, a lot of times it comes from listening to music. Often to get into a creative place, I will put on a lot of music, from all types of artists, especially ones that inspire me a lot. And to get into like this kind of meditative place, I might smoke a little grass and go walk out in the mountains, and just kind of let my mind be open and just kind of look at everything around me. And it's nice hiking the mountains because you have like this vantage point of the entire community and then and the entire city, and you can kind of visualize all these little mini dramas going on everywhere. And you get kind of I you're right, and you get like all these
Yeah,
like
you can definitely do that. That's true.
ideas from that. So that part's really fun, like the whole like kind of getting the initial inspiration for an idea flowing. It's easy. It's so easy to do that. The hard part is coming back and actually sitting down and making that a reality. And that's the part
Yeah.
that can be kind of torturous. Especially if let's say I went out, I had this idea for this film. I went out and shot it, and we did all the filming. I bring it back into my editing bay. And it can be kind of torturous at first because you're watching all this footage and you're looking at all the things you wish you had done differently. And you're totally tortured by it. Like all the mistakes you made, all the things, I wish I had done this, I wish I had done that. Oh, shoot, we ran out of budget to do this. And so that kind of builds up a lot of anxiety, which can also cripple you and not allow any muse to come in because you're just, too plagued with anxiety over, you're looking at yourself in the mirror and your work in the mirror. So
Right.
oftentimes when it comes to that stage, I find, unfortunately, I end up procrastinating a lot. And the only way to break that procrastination is just to sit down and just start working. And that's the hard labor part of it. And that's not always as free flowing. Eventually, if you just work long enough at it, it does get back to that effortless place, where you're in contact with something that, like something higher or something divine that inspires you. But it takes a while to get there sometimes when you're, worried about, whether your footage is any good or whatever. Once you're done kind of, with all your self-doubts and you're done like analyzing every frame of everything and seeing all its flaws.
Yeah, it's something that you tapped on there, that you were talking about, is that sense of you know, creating all that footage, and in the moment it seemed magical and amazing. You get it back to the editing bay and you're like, oh, it's not quite what I hoped for. And it's interesting because you go from that very magical place into a place of complete judgment.
Right.
And it's like a complete buzzkill. It like takes the creative, it totally massacres the creative process in one fell swoop.
Oh, yeah.
Know, unless you've been through it enough to know that that's actually part of the beauty of it.
Yeah, I have. And it does get better. I hadn't directed something in a few years, and I have been directing this piece recently, and that was the one where I was like, kind of like, oh, man, I should have done this, I should have done that, blah, blah, blah. But, and plus, like, the genesis of it was not my idea. Like, I was actually hired to direct it, so.
Yes.
But
it's a little different because you're working within parameters, right?
I'm working within parameters. I have to make sure that her vision's being realized. And, I mean, I am, you know, in line with her vision, and that's why, you know, she hired me to do it and all that. But, you know, there's other things to worry about, like, you know, how is she going to like this? How are audiences going to like this? How are, you know, so you start worrying about all these things. Where, like, as a kid, you never worried about, I mean, there was no audience. There was no one expecting to see the outcome of the 3-day-long Star Wars action figure marathon thing that me and my sister were doing down in the basement. There was no expectations of it. So there was it was free from worry or anxiety or judgment. It just was.
George Lucas wasn't dictating what you were doing.
Nobody was. And it was pure and it was beautiful. But if you want to be a serious artist in the adult world and get yourself out there, you know, you have to have a certain business acumen. And you know, and that often, even though it's necessary, you know, can really get in the way of allowing that force to flow in and out of you.
Yeah, that's it's. I don't know if you've read this book. You know, Jeff's a very avid reader, so he and I have lots of conversations about that. Have you read the book?
I used to be an avid reader.
Really? You haven't been reading?
No, I have no time. I'm just I'm like working all the time, but I am at heart an avid reader, and I will, you know, actually I get all my best reading done when I'm traveling.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
If I'm on a plane or a train going somewhere, like I'll get like 4 or 5 books, you know, read in that period. But man, like when I'm back here, you know, after working film preservation all day and then going home and helping Layla with her homework and then editing all night and then planning out something I'm directing this weekend, there's just, I have no energy to read, which is sad because I know it's like, you know, I need to. It helps bolster my, you know, my intellect.
There's a book called The War of Art by.
Yeah, I'm always at war with art.
Yeah, have you read that book?
No, it sounds good though.
It's by Stephen Pressfield, and he talks about there's this difference when anything you're creating, whether it's an artistic project or you're an artist or whether you're starting a business as an entrepreneur, there's a level of when you're first starting out, you're playing really at the amateur level, which is kind of like what you're talking about with, you know, with your experience as a child. You know, you had this film and you could just work on it whenever you wanted, whenever you felt inspired. There was no need, there was no drive, there were no parameters, there were no limits.
Right.
And then you get into the adult world, and you're working with parameters, and you're running into things like procrastination, you're running into fear. The fear can actually keep you back. But what he's talking about is this evolution of going from the amateur into the pro. And how the pro knows that that's just part of that. You know, like you were just describing, you know, going into the editing bay and saying, okay, well, this isn't exactly what I wanted, but I know how I can work with it. And I know this is just a phase we're going to get through, and we're going to get to the other side of this, and it's going to be great. So I found that very interesting in the book that he was talking about that process, because I even saw that with my own writing, how I would just, like, things got too intense. I'd be like, ooh, I'm just going to put that aside, and I'm just going to focus on my day job. I'm just not going to even, like, look at that. But as I got more serious about my writing later on, I got to that place like you were describing where it's like, okay, no, this isn't what I thought it was. I'm just going to work through it. It'll get there. I'm just going to let it be, and I'm going to move forward, and I'm going to take little baby steps even though, you know, I don't quite know what I'm doing. It's kind of like this blind faith that we take as an artist. Would you agree?
You have to just start laying something down. And just building upon that. And then, you know, maybe your first attempt isn't so great. But at least that first attempt gave you a template or an idea to move forward, to your second attempt at it. But right, the big important part is the work that goes into it after the first divine inspiration. There was always like this myth that was perpetrated about when I was in high school and college about these artists throughout history who had like these divine inspirations for things, such as Samuel Taylor Coleridge. He was like the romantic poet in the late 18th century. And there's always like this myth about him that, he'd smoke opium and he had like all these hallucinations. And after one of these, opium smoking sessions, he magically came up with the entire poet, the entire poem called Kubla Khan. And
Oh,
you
wow.
ever heard Kubla Khan?
It's been a long time. I don't really remember it well, but
Like it was like, in Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately
yes,
pleasure ground
okay.
decree, right?
Yes,
That
yes,
one. So
yes.
like that myth that like somehow, and that's not what happened at all, actually. He might have had the initial image of, Kubla Khan from that opium dream, but that opium dream did not just manifest into this ready-made poem. And that was like a myth that I think has hurt a lot of artists, and they get really frustrated because they think it should just come effortlessly. And it doesn't come effortlessly. Or the whole, legend of Keith Richards dreaming up the riff for Satisfaction and like in his sleep. Like, okay, wow, Keith has dreamed this whole song. That's totally amazing. And went back to bed and came back and recorded it right away in the studio. That's not how it happened. He dreamt a tiny part of one riff, then went in the studio and they worked hard to make the song a reality. So
Well, and also before he even had that dream, he had years and years and years of experience
Yeah, exactly.
as a
Of
musician or
working really
writing or
hard,
whatever.
of laboring really hard. Like I remember at the time when they first started even writing songs, because they weren't songwriters originally, they were covering like a lot of old blues standards. And the Beatles were like the big songwriters, and their manager, Andrew Lew Goldham, basically said to them, "Hey, if you want to keep competing with the Beatles, you boys need to come up with your own material." So he actually locked them in a kitchen. They were locked in this kitchen for an entire day before they finally came up with one song. So I'm sure that was a torturous process for them because they had never done that before.
What
But,
song did they come up with? I'm just curious because I haven't
I
heard the
think they
story
came up with,
before.
of all songs, As Tears Go By, which is like
Oh, really?
that really sweet, I mean, it's very atypical for the Stones, right? It's a very
Yeah,
sweet,
it is. It is.
childlike
Yeah.
ballad where like
Yeah.
Jagger's like, singing at the playground, wishing he can, be like these innocent children, even though Jagger was not really innocent.
No, that is not a word I would associate with him.
No, exactly.
Definitely not. If you do word association, Mick Jagger, that is not the word that's going to come up.
But that lie, I think, has hurt a lot of artists, especially those who, when I was younger, a lot of people around me, including myself, were taking psychedelics for the same reason. We thought like instant inspiration, instant genius, that, this whole idea of like this shortcut to genius. And yeah, you can get some pretty interesting visions and ideas, all that, but to actually make any of that stuff, manifest in the real world takes a lot of hard work. And I think a lot of artists get frustrated when, like, they realize that, and some, decide not to pursue it. But so it's this kind of balancing act between, actual, what I believe is divine inspiration, and hard work.
Yeah, you definitely have to put the time and effort into it. And that was one of the things I've been drilling into my brother over the last few years. And
Well,
I
he's a
think
hard
even,
worker.
yeah, the audience out there kind of knows for the most part. My little brother is in film school right now, back east, and studying cinematography. That's his slant on the film industry, and
That's a great slant to get into.
he's actually
It
worked with Jeff before
is.
on a project, and he, when he was really getting serious about his art, which was probably about 4 years ago, he would come to me and he'd be so frustrated, and I'd be like, "Good." He's like, "What?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you're supposed to hit this. You hit a wall, and it's your," I said, "the wall is there to teach you. The wall is there to say, do you really want this?" Or, because I said there are always ways around the wall. You can climb the wall, you can bust through the wall, you can go around the other corner. I'm like, there's always ways around it. It's just you have to want it bad enough.
I think you know what Jim Morrison would have done.
What?
He would have broke on through the other side. Come on, a little Doors humor for Friday afternoon. All right.
I love that. I love that. I love that. I love that. Oh my God, that was good. That was good. Yeah, but it's really. I mean, and really, Jim did do that.
Yeah,
I know. Doors are phenomenal.
And,
there's never been any band that have even touched them. They're kind of irreverent.
Are they your favorite band?
The Doors?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I have a favorite band.
Yeah,
you know, it's really hard for me to limit it to just one. I mean, there are so many.
It is tough. It is tough. Even though we all know it's truly the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Or the Beatles.
Or the Beatles, or one of those. I mean, it's really hard for any musician to compete with that.
Yeah.
It really is.
Well,
I mean, it's the there are different.
And that can limit you as well. You know, we're talking about things that hamper, like allowing the muse to come through. Is that kind of thing? This comparison to other artists can really be a poisonous thing. We're like,
completely.
Not as good as, this, or, oh, man, my film isn't quite as good as Robert Altman, or blah, blah, or whatever. You know, that's a poisonous thing. Because, for one thing, you're never going to be Robert Altman, because Robert Altman was Robert Altman.
Right.
Your own creativity is in and of yourself, and it comes from you. And even if you tried to, let's say, remake a Robert Altman film, it would still be totally different because it's seen through the prism of your own soul, your own eyes. And, people just need to try to perfect who they are and not worry about comparisons. I mean, you can totally be inspired by people. I mean, I certainly am. Inspired by their techniques and stuff. But, no artist can truly copy another artist. They can attempt to. Some come close, I suppose. But usually, you can see right through it. But yeah, that whole like judging, oh man, like this guy achieved all this great stuff by the age of 25, and here I am, I'm like, 35 or whatever, and I haven't achieved all that yet. That whole comparing like someone else's achievements to yours, I mean, we're all different people and we all evolve differently. So
yes.
it's not fair to ever do that, and there is no age limit to, creating artistic greatness.
That's so true. And a lot of people get really frustrated with that. Or they think they have some preconceived notion of some imaginary timeline that, they have to complete it in this amount of time, or they have to be successful or famous in this amount of time. It just doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. I mean, I suffered from that when I was in my 20s. I felt I had I wanted to be super successful as a filmmaker by like 27. And I would hit myself over the head. I would hit myself over the head about it all the time, just like really upset. I mean, that wasn't going to happen anyway because I almost dropped out of filmmaking for a few years. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. After college, like I had a lot of fun making films at USC, but I didn't really fit into the USC film school paradigm. I was making just these really weird, avant-garde, experimental, just weird films that kind of just weirded out a lot of my classmates, except for my friends. but I had a lot of fun. Like, I was learning how to make films, so I was like, I'm just going to go all balls out and make, like, films like Louis Buñuel used to or Jodorowsky and just make these really weird films. But after film school, because especially USC is so, like, George Lucas, Robert Zemeckis, Hollywood industry, mm-hmm. and I didn't. At that time, at least, I didn't see a place for myself in the Hollywood film industry. And I'd become so in love with music, I started playing out as a musician for about 2 years.
I did not know. Wow.
This is before I even met Terry, actually. I didn't really, play for money much, but I played, like, tons of coffee houses. I'd play, like, every open mic place you could go to. I wrote songs all the time. That, I would say, was probably my most effortless era, where I was just kind of having direct communication from somewhere else. I was just had my transmitters up on my head and songs were just coming to me, and
Wow.
they were really surreal, and but I didn't judge them, and because I didn't really have any explicit career motives behind them, I just wanted to play out and be a musician. Like, it was very honest and very good. But over after about 2 years, I realized there's only so far I'm going to go as a musician, because I'm not really, like, I am a musician, I play music, I love music, but I'm not really a musician. I just know that's really not my final calling as far as, like, the definitive, type of art that will define my career, because it's
Right.
always been about film. I was like, I have to find a way to get back into film, because that's my first love, my truest love. I think I can do the most important stuff with film. So then I slowly started getting back into that. And I made a short film called Sex Sucks, early around 1999, 2000. That was really fun. It was kind of a rip-off of a Woody Allen movie. But that gave me the confidence to do Pony Boy. And Pony Boy
Okay.
and Pony Boy is a really interesting case study, because that film, I mean, it was based on an incident in my life in 1996 where I was really poor, had no money, wasn't sure how I was going to survive in Hollywood in another week. And I looked in the back of the LA Weekly. There was an ad that said photographers wanted. I did happen to have a camera. Wasn't a digital camera, because it was 1995. It was a Nikon or something, I think. And so I was like, okay, I can do that. I can take pictures. So I went to this ranch. I didn't have a car at the time either, so I'd take the bus all the way to this ranch. And this Egyptian guy, he met me there, brought me back there, gave me about 20 minutes worth of pony handling instructions, and then drove us down into Boyle Heights in East LA and
Oh
dropped
my
us off
God.
and said, I'll pick you back up here at 4:30. Just go door to door. Here's the order forms. Try and sell pony pictures, because it's a tradition in the Mexican community to have their children photographed on ponies. So
Oh, okay.
I'm going door to door. I speak no Spanish at all, like this total gringo there. I'm trying to communicate this, and also, like, the prices were like crazy high, like
Oh,
$40
really?
picture packages. I mean, these people were poor. It was like
Right. The
$40 picture packages, $50 picture packages. They were, like, kind of laughing at me, and I don't blame them. And finally, I got one customer, and she put the child on the on the pony, started crying, so I couldn't get the picture. And then, next thing you know, there's all these misadventures. I was almost, this guy threatened to shoot me, and cholos were laughing as I was walking by. My pony was taking dumps everywhere on the sidewalk. It was a total comedy show, right? So anyway, so I came back from that night, and I started telling everybody about this story, about how I had this day doing this pony boy job. And people just made me tell this story over and over and over again. In fact, at my grandmother's funeral, my grandmother's sister wanted to hear the story, and it actually made her laugh, which was cool, like at my grandmother's funeral.
Oh, wow, that's
And
good.
so a couple of friends of mine wanted to write a screenplay about it, because they thought the story was so funny. And I was like, well, I'm going to write the screenplay, because I lived this. And
Right.
so that was the genesis of Pony Boy. But the thing about the actual production of Pony Boy that I want to get to, as far as, like, the muse goes, Pony Boy started off, I was very nervous going to Pony Boy, because it was the first time I had kind of a sizable crew, a cast and crew. I'd never really directed with more than, like, five people around. So this is, and we had like 20, 25, we had grips, we had everything. So, camera assist,
Wow.
line producer, just everything. So, like, the very first day we were getting ready to film, like, I threw up, because I was just like, I was just a ball of nerves, wasn't sure how we were going to pull this off. And, I wasn't sure how the actors would do. I had some rehearsals with them, and, Foster Tim starred in it, and my friend Andrea Fellers. And I wasn't sure with the chemistry and everything. So I was really nervous about it. And the first day went by okay. It was kind of a little stagey at times, I felt. Some of the earlier scenes in Pony Boy, I feel, aren't quite as natural as some of the later stuff. So the next, so but I watched how they worked. I watched how the actors interacted with each other, and I could tell that Foster Timms was not a guy that took very well to line readings. But I knew, just knowing him as a person, that he would shine if he just improvised. So I changed my entire strategy, and I just let the scenes flow. And
Oh, wow.
I let Foss totally improvise, and I directed everyone around him to just respond to him honestly, whatever he was doing. And from that point on, I think the film felt very natural and almost effortless. it was and very playful, and it got back. There was no stress because we were all like on this adventure together and just like exploring and letting our subconscious guide us into different scenarios. And like a lot of things in Pony Boy that happened on screen were barely even planned. They just happened. You know,
oh, wow.
Most of the film was improvised. And that was very, very freeing. I felt in that instance, I was very, very connected to the muse because
yeah.
I wasn't judging anything. I wasn't analyzing. I mean, I made sure that I was getting the shots I needed. And I made sure that a scene would start a certain way and end a certain way and communicate something I needed it to communicate. But, and it happened in a certain amount of time, but I gave them all so much freedom that it actually liberated the movie. I think makes it such a fun movie to watch. And it feels very real to a lot of people, which is really cool. I think that's why.
Yeah, I didn't know that there was that much improvisation in it. I mean, I've always loved the movie, and I saw it when it originally screened, the first time you screened it. I was there for that. And then didn't you did something at Arclight as well?
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, I had a few screenings.
That was a long time ago, but.
Yeah, at the Arclight, and my mom came out for that, which was really nice.
Yes.
And, I screened again in Boulder, Colorado. I had a number of screenings, and they always were met, you know, very well. Because the film, it's very fun. It's a good film, kind of like a day in the life kind of thing, and
mm-hmm.
very free flowing. And I don't know, like I felt that was the most fun I ever had as a filmmaker was making that movie because we just let it happen, as opposed to like this highly structured beast that just you have to whip into shape every second we kind of turned off our analytical minds and just let it happen.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned the whole analytical side of it because film does have an aspect of that. You know,
mm-hmm.
screenplays naturally are very formulaic.
And, right.
And just the way, a movie is shot is formulaic. You know,
yeah.
They're let's shoot this on this day. It's all very structured in some way.
Yeah, and in many cases it has to be because the budgets are massive. Pony Boy, I had the luxury of being able to shoot in order. Like in other words,
mm-hmm.
The first scene I shot on the first day, the second scene the second day, third scene. But you really can't do that with big scale motion pictures because you can't, run from, a big epic battle scene on the beach and then on one day and then go to, like, some intimate, mansion dinner scene the second day and then go back to the beach on the third. You have to do all the beach stuff first. Yeah, and then you have to
right.
go, it's like, just logistically impossible to do it any other way.
Yeah, it's interesting to have the behind-the-curtain experience.
Right.
I went to film school too, for those of you out there
who
are listening. But I didn't complete. it's because I didn't do my dissertation. It was graduate level, and I.
That's okay. Some best filmmakers who ever lived didn't even go to film school.
I know. So I didn't do my dissertation, so I don't technically have my MFA, but I did complete my coursework. But
why spend all this money in school when you can just take that money and make a movie? I've told people that all the time because, I'm still paying student loans to USC to this day, which is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, and I'm still paying student loans, too.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well. So
I could have taken all that money and just made a film.
That's exactly it because, it's like, you look at all the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars, and it's like, wow, I could have had a really nice film here.
Yeah,
nice indie.
Right, absolutely.
But it was interesting for me because it was a total perception shift because it's always, all of a sudden, it was just like when I worked in the music industry. It's like the veil comes off and you see what it's actually like
mm-hmm.
and what goes into, producing a song and what goes into, producing a show and things like that. And it's all of a sudden it's like kind of like the mystery, like the innocence of it is lost to a certain extent. Cause you're like,
Oh yeah.
Well, okay.
Because it's a very complicated affair.
it really is on both ends, both music and film being on the behind the scenes of it is it's not so glamorous.
And that's the hard work of it. You know, like the hard work
earlier. People don't, it's funny because, I've run into people before that, especially, you know, knowing my work in the music industry and knowing that I worked in the music industry for a while, like, in awe, like, oh, that's so cool. Like,
right.
Sitting in a recording studio all day long is not so cool. Let me tell you, it is treacherous.
Sitting on the film set all day long is not very cool.
That's the same thing. Exactly. It's like there might be 39 takes of the same shot. I mean, I worked on when I was in film school, I worked on a video, a music video. And I was a script supervisor that day. And, you know, script supervisor for video is actually quite humorous. So, but I was sitting there and I was like, oh, my gosh. And it was like a 16-hour day for, a two- or three-minute music video?
I mean, like, always on those things, if someone says, oh, yeah, you know, like, we'll be in and out in 8 hours, expect, like, 12.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
It's just always
like,
right?
Like, oh, it's going to be short. Yeah, it's only going to be 6 hours. Okay. Yeah. No, it's not.
Or beware of this. Oh, yeah, you know, we can knock this out. I bet we can do the whole thing in under $2,000. And then next thing you know, you spent like $7,000-$8,000.
Right.
Because it's just, you know, it always costs time and money. All these things do, you know, especially because you want to be good. And just, you know, to get it good sometimes it takes extra resources, extra time.
Yes, it does. It does. But, you know, the end result is magical. So I remember.
Absolutely.
I remember when you were shooting Ponyboy because I heard a lot about it. I wasn't necessarily on set when you were shooting, but I remember hearing about it. And then when I saw it, it was just magical. Because I remember some of the challenges you were running into and stuff like that. And I remember just watching it, just being in awe. Just like, oh, this is amazing, you know?
Yeah, and the editing process, actually, I felt was very much, like, guided by the whole muse thing we're talking about, that was very free flowing. Like it actually took me about a year to edit it because my editor and great friend and colleague Blake West, he was an editor Monday through Friday, working like late nights all the time, so he could only edit the film on Saturdays. So our ritual every single Saturday was every morning we go for a hike, smoke some weed. talk about like what we were gonna do. Come back, make a big breakfast. Start listening to some music. Maybe play some music. Right around 4 p.m. we started, right? And we would edit to like 1, 2 in the morning. But we were on fire. We were totally. We had so much fun with it. We tried so many things we never even thought we would try. As far as like the editing decisions. In fact, when Blake, who's directed and edited a lot of very professional things ever since then, he recently went to the screen of Ponyboy. He was like, man, the one, I really like that film. Like, it reminded me of the person I used to be. And I asked him, like, what you meant by that? He's like, I used to take a lot more chances, but, with the editing and stuff. And I thought that was really cool. And I know why we took chances, because we were just totally allowing our creativity to flow. We had our transmitters up. We weren't really judging things harshly at all. You know, it's like we didn't mind making crazy cuts and inserting a 5-minute sequence of Foss falling asleep on a park bench talking to a bug. we weren't afraid to do it. I mean, that wasn't even in the script. It just happened, and we weren't afraid to show all that stuff. And it just makes the whole film just seem so organic and so natural. And that's the type of films like I like to make.
Yeah, and you know what I like that we're starting to see more of a resurgence of that. It's harder to find, of course, and I think if you live in a big city like L.A., you can find indie houses where you can go and see films like this. And you can find.
It has gotten harder, though. It has gotten harder. You know, there used to be a lot more indie film houses than there are now, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it seems though that there are more celebrities, and I'm speaking of actors and actresses that see the importance of indie film and are supporting it and backing it as much as they can. So that's nice to see.
And a lot of the indie filmmakers have had such a hard time raising budgets for their visions. A lot of them have gone into television.
Yes, and so that's that's why television has gotten really amazing.
Yeah, no, it has. I think a lot of the greatest talent has gone into making these wonderful TV shows we all love, you know, whether it be Game of Thrones or Mad Men or whatever.
Right, right. And, well, what's interesting is lately there's this surgence of crowdfunding for films, for indie films.
Yeah, yeah.
And people are getting behind it and getting really excited about it. I think my dad's a huge Star Trek fan, and he mentioned that I guess there's a new Star Trek film that is being crowdfunded right now.
Really?
I can't remember the name of it. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's supposed to be.
It seems like they would need
a lot of money.
For
timeline, that. It's supposed to be before, like, the original Star Trek series, like the whole Captain Kirk thing. It's supposed to be way before that. So it's almost like a prequel to a prequel. But
so
it's my understanding. Yes, yes. It's my understanding that it's being crowdfunded right now. So
okay.
I'm like, wow, that's kind of cool.
Well, yeah,
and people are really passionate about it. So
that's an army right there, the Star Trek fan base.
Oh, God, yes. Huge, huge. Massive.
Huge, as Donald Trump would say. Sorry,
so,
like I know. Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about a project. You don't have to go into too much detail if you don't want to. There's a project that Jeff has been working on for quite some time that,
yeah, I know exactly that.
Featuring a Brazilian band from the 60s.
Yeah.
And it's actually, the film itself and the premise behind it is pretty cool, but what's been really amazing to me is to see the unfoldment of how many people are out there that love this band, and there's such a following, and so I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about that, Jeff.
And the unfoldment of my psychosis that has come with
this project. Well, there's that too, but there's also, so if you could talk a little bit about that, and you know, but talk about the project you're working on right now that you're doing.
I've seen
a little bit of that, and it's pretty cool, too. So if you want to
do
the nutshell version of both, that'd be great.
About all that. Yeah, the Ultimate Tantes project, what happened after Pony Boy, I was like, okay, what kind of film should I make now? Because the next film I actually need to raise money for, Pony Boy, I actually self-financed. Because I was working a union job at the time. And I made pretty good cash. And so the reason, actually, probably my poor wife and family doesn't have a house right now and a car is because I spent all this money early on making movies, you know. And Pony Boy, because I had my own cash, I could do whatever I wanted. But I was like, okay, the next thing I do, I need to have a built-in audience, I think, because I couldn't just jump into Pony Boy 2 because I ran out of cash. I wasn't going to ever do that again as far as, like, you know, finance my own movie. So Os Mutantes came out of we had pitched this series around town called Underground Legends of Rock and Roll, which is going to be about, like, you know, Patti Smith, Velvet Underground, MC5, you know, everybody, anybody, you know, the band Love that I love.
Mm-hmm.
But and Os Mutantes was one of these bands that we wanted to profile on this show. It's funny, I actually went to VH1 and pitched it, right? And I did a pretty good job. And at the end of the pitch, the woman actually told me, she was like, have you watched VH1 recently? I'm like, well, yeah, a little bit. She's like, do you see much music on it? I was like, well, no, but there should be. That's why I'm pitching this show. They're like, well, our programming's kind of changed. I'm like, well, I guess I wasted my time here then, haven't I? So anyway, like, out of that project, I fell in love with this band, Os Mutantes. I just thought they made Beatles, Stones. I seriously put this band up there. Their music, song per song, is as good as Beatles songs. I mean, they're super melodic. They're multifaceted. They have all these different parts and arrangements. The harmonies are insane. The sounds on those records. I mean, they made all their own instruments by hand, like using parts of like their mother's sewing machine. They took the motor off of that. All types of just bizarre things. They made their own theremin. They made all their own guitars by hand, and these guitars sounded like no other guitar I've ever heard in my life. So when you hear their music, there are sounds on those records that are not duplicated in any other rock band.
On top
of that, it's like there's this great romantic historical backdrop to the whole thing, because you have like this military government that is, you know, basically, you know, taking over and oppressing the people and destroying freedom of speech and suspending habeas corpus and jailing all dissidents and artists, and some of their friends were imprisoned and eventually exiled into London, and some were tortured. The Mutantes themselves had to flee town, live in these communes. And on top of all that, there's a love story in there, because the band consisted of two brothers, Arnaldo and Sergio Diaz, and Rita Lee. Rita and Arnaldo were high school sweethearts. So the story of Los Mutantes is also the story of Arnaldo and Rita's relationship, marriage, and eventual divorce. Unfortunately, because of all the hardship and tragedy that their personal relationships had to go through in 1973, they still have not recovered from that emotionally, and they're still at odds with each other over all the things that, you know, what, you know, Arnaldo did things to Rita, Rita did things to Arnaldo. They've not forgiven each other for all this went down in 1973. And because of it, wow, it's been a very, very difficult project to get off the ground, because, as you know, if I'm making a movie about a band, I need the music rights.
And that's, yes.
And that's been the big, that's been the biggest issue. And
yeah,
my vision for the film is I wanted to do half of it animated, like in the style of Yellow Submarine. I wanted to bring all these fantastical things that the Los Mutantes did. They gave free concerts in the countryside to the poor people. They play on top of a bus. You know, they kind of traveled around like musical Robin Hoods doing this kind of stuff. They had these shows on television that were just totally insane. So they did very, very provocative things. Unfortunately, the original footage is all gone, so I want to recreate all that through animation. They did these concerts where they got into huge fights with the crowd, and the crowds would throw things at them. And, you know, I want to recreate all that stuff through animation. Like, it would have been this really, really glorious Valentine to Brazilian rock and roll culture in the 1960s, plus a great history lesson for people who aren't from that part of the world.
Right.
So when I first wrote it, my very early screenplay I wrote it with Steve Kudrowski, a friend of mine. And that was just a joy to write. I mean, we were in love with the subject. It flowed effortlessly, just how something should. I've noticed that every subsequent screenplay I've done, as my frustrations amount with the project, they become more and more torturous to write, because I've been met with so much resistance, so much disappointment, that the last draft I did it took me a long time to write it, because I was kind of writing it out of fear. I was like, okay, is this page going to offend somebody? Is this page going to offend somebody?
Oh, when you're,
you know, so you're kind of like self-censoring yourself as you write.
Yeah.
And that's no way to be creative.
No.
So, yeah, unfortunately, I had to abandon the project for now. I always had a really solid alliance with Sergio Diaz, who's been wonderful, a wonderful friend and compadre in this, and he was one of the original band members. But the other two they have personal issues with each other, and because of it, I could never get the music rights. So now it's on the back of the stove on a low simmer.
and that's fine. You know, we were when we did our we did an interview with Richard Danielson, the drummer of Vintage Trouble, and he was saying that there was a time where he kind of had to shelve playing the drums,
right?
Because he had gone through a similar experience where, you know, it wasn't quite what he wanted, or he was in bands that just wasn't clicking. He just wasn't feeling it, and it was just getting to be too much. And so he took some time off of it. And then, you know, look where he is now. So there's something to be said of just letting it go and letting it go under the back burner.
Oh, yeah.
I've done that with my books, too. So, you know, you just saw my process, actually, with before my book Star Maker came out, how there was a few years there where it just sat on the back burner and I was doing nothing with it because I just was so frustrated. And I had gone through so many rejections from agents and publishers that I was kind of over it, and I just didn't know where to go.
Yeah.
So I just plopped it on the back burner, and then it did end up coming to fruition. It's just sometimes I think the back burner provides some clarity and actually peace of mind for you, because, you know, you can drive yourself crazy.
Oh, yeah. And those books that you wrote, like, you were, like, possessed by the muse, right? Like, you wrote those things, like, in, like, like a week time or something. Like it was insane. You're like pumping out like volume after volume after volume, and you're like, "Hey Jeff, I just wrote these 5 books last month." I was like, "What the hell?"
Yeah, it was a very odd time. I was having quite the love affair with the muse.
You know, but, and that's great because it sounds like at that time you were able to go back to the garden, as Joni Mitchell would say. Like you were
Yes,
in
yes.
that state of childhood, rapture.
I
Right?
was, I was. And I was blessed
You weren't censoring yourself. You weren't really thinking about how this would play to the public that much. You were just having fun, which is what, all creative people should be doing.
Yes.
And writing this story, which was loosely based on probably the experiences you had.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly what the experience was, is I just made it as fun as I possibly could. And it just kept flowing out and flowing out and flowing out. And it was a very magical time. And I remember, talking with you and talking with Terry, and you guys were like, what is going on? Because it seemed like every time I'd come over, I'd be like,
It was
oh yeah,
impressive. It was
I
totally
just wrote another
impressive.
book.
I was like, damn, I'm not pulling my weight around here. She's like knocking out 5 books in a month. I'm like, how am I doing?
Yeah, it was the right timing, and I was in the right space to do it, and I just fully allowed it, and it was an amazing time. I look back on it fondly, but it was also really demanding. I mean, like I said, it was a love affair with a muse. It was like being in a really possessive relationship because I really didn't have that much time to myself, and I was constantly writing. And luckily at the time, I was not working in corporate, and I was not doing that much consulting at the time. And I luckily was able to write all the time. So that's what my days were. But the thing was, it's like, some of my friends like disappeared. I lost friends, which, I guess they really weren't friends in hindsight,
That
but
can be a very good thing sometimes.
it can be because, it was like that tight circle, that close-knit group that I had, they remained. And they kind of understood my crazy museness that was going on, and I just allowed. And, when I came out on the other side of it, in essence, I produced during that time, it was something like 18 books. So now are they all ready to go to market? Are they ready to be published today? No, they're not. But they still, in fact, I'm rewriting book four right now for a 2016 release. But
Well, that comes in the hard work, like the more analytical work,
that
follow.
is the analytical work. That is in the rewriting for tone and looking
Which is
at,
not always, so musy.
no,
I mean, it can be,
no.
but like usually it's more like, okay, I need to get this, shaped in a certain type of way for a certain type of reason. And
Exactly. And there's some books that, I may never release, and that's okay. I'm okay with that. But the Star Maker series will have a completion. I just don't know when its completion date will be, but book four will be coming out in 2016. But it was a really interesting process. It was very demanding. The muse was very demanding.
I'm sure, guess. Yeah, like you had a harsh muse taskmaster.
I did. She was just like drilling me. She's like, "Come on, let's go. Let's keep writing. Let's keep writing." I mean, literally, I'd sit down to write, and I'm naturally a night person, so I'm not good with waking up really early in the morning. So I'd start my day probably around 10 a.m. and I'd be writing. I'd get some stuff done, of course, but I'd be writing by noon. And then all of a sudden, it would be dark outside. I'm like, "What just happened? What time is it?" And then maybe I'd eat a little bit, and then all of a sudden it would be 1 a.m. and I'd be like, "What is going on here?" And I don't think I watched TV for like 6 months. I think I just had earbuds in the whole time, like drilling music. And the music was really inspiring me. I had the music really worked around the storyline, so it constantly gave the muse fuel. So it was a really interesting process. It's crazy. I don't know that I'd ever want to go through it again. It was a little insane. Like you talk about that artistic insanity that ensues, that was definitely happening.
Oh yeah, it is insanity, but you know, an enlightened insanity.
Yes.
Or
so
candy.
tell us real quickly about this project that you're working on right now that you're directing.
Oh, that I was hired by this girl named Christina Barcy. She had a radio show that ran for 2 years, like an old-timey style radio show, science fiction themed, about a girl who wakes up. She's a girl who's split into three different women, and they wake up in
Oh,
three
wow.
different locations, and they have to try to figure out like who their real identity is.
Oh,
And
that's
that's,
cool.
yeah, so that's like the story of the show. And it originally started as a documentary. Her show was coming to an end, and she wanted me to just document, the whole genesis of the show, and then of course the finale. She wanted me to do some behind the scenes stuff and film them, like, recording it at a Pooh Bah Records is where they actually did it at.
Oh, wow. I didn't
Yeah,
even know that still existed.
it does. It moved locations, so
Oh,
it's.
okay.
Yeah, like it's in Colorado now. I think before it was like on Walnut or something, Pasadena.
Yeah. Was that, yeah,
Yeah,
I think it was
so
on
I filmed
Walnut.
all that, and then knowing me, I decided to get more ambitious, and I was like, well, let's recreate some of the stuff that happens on the show. So I started filming some things, some dramatic things that happen on the show. Then I was like, hey, let's film you guys actually doing the radio show, but like on a sound stage where I can actually control like the lighting and the atmosphere and the mood and smoke machines and just get like really, really kind of cool. So we did that. And so now it's funny enough, now she's trying to sell it as a television show. So I
Oh,
had to
nice.
repurpose it, all that stuff that we had shot as a documentary, and repurpose it as for a 1 minute trailer. Which, it came out pretty good. I think it's a pretty remarkable piece, and yeah, I hope it goes somewhere. But yeah, so that's one of many things I'm working on right now.
Yes, you've always got a lot of different things you're working on,
Oh, I have so much going on. Yeah.
which is exciting. That's exciting,
Yeah.
though. It's as an artist, it's always wonderful to have a lot of balls in the air rather than none.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have so many ideas. I have ideas to last me all the way to the end. And I'm sure I'll have plenty more. I'm inspired by so many things, from things that are going on in the world around me to things that are going on, in my own home, things that are going around in my neighborhood, things that are going around the world stage, politics. I mean, everything inspires me. Other movies, music, women, everything. What is, I mean, those are the muses, really. I mean, the muse is I mean, I guess the muse is God, really, but there's two parts to God, right? Or maybe there's more. There's the ethereal part to God and the ephemeral. And the ethereal is your spirituality. The ephemeral is more like your sexuality. And when both are invoked properly, I feel the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, like a shiver down my spine, and the creative energy becomes effortless because I'm literally and almost unconsciously receiving signals like a radio tower. I saw a quote by Bob Dylan. He was interviewed by Ed Wallace on 60 Minutes, and he was asked if he could write songs the way he wrote them back in the 60s. He said no. And he asked him, how come? He's like, that stuff happened outside of me. It happened, I don't know how those songs even came to me. They came completely and consciously, and I can't summon it, that energy, the way I used to be able to summon it. He's like, I can do other things now better, my performances, playing with a band and everything. I can write certain types of songs really, really good now, but those songs, those ones that you're referring to, the classic songs, like I don't know, I don't know how they came to me. I don't know if I can quite summon up the resources to get them back. Right?
Yeah, I think that lends itself to being really appreciative of whatever the way is that the muse decides to find you in
Right.
whatever time and place. Like, for example, with Pony Boy, like you just went with that intuitive nudge to just let it free flow, and look at how brilliant it turned out. But could you replicate that again? Probably not.
I think I could actually. I think I could replicate that experience again, especially if I worked with the same people.
But it wouldn't be exactly the same.
No, of course not. I mean, because things have changed. I've changed. They've changed. It's like, yeah. So it would be different.
It'd have a different texture to it.
It would. It would. I do actually have an idea for a Ponyboy sequel, by the way.
Oh, you do?
Oh yeah,
Oh, how fun.
that's one of I have about five or six projects right now that we're all simultaneously working on. That's one of them.
Awesome. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of later down the line, to be honest, because I'm trying to get some other things in the pipeline first, but yeah. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Jeff, thank you so much for spending time with me today and with our audience. I think that they're just going to get so much out of this interview. There's so many amazing things that have come to light and just a lot of magic in this interview today. So thank you for that.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. I was trying to let the muse come through me when we were talking. So.
Awesome. Well, once again, thank you, and we will be back again next week for another episode of Invoking the Muse. The series will continue, and I hope you all have a fabulous week. This is Jessica Nevins for the Divine It Girl Radio Show. Love and sparkles.